From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past September in Portland, when a team of filmmakers with roots in the Rochester area took home the Audience Award in the 2015 Portland Film Festival. Their film is called Sympathy Said the Shark, and it aims to offer a new way of telling a story, kind of a psychological thriller, and soon to make its Rochester debut. This hour, we delve into the artistic questions in play when filmmakers seek to create a psychological drama. What works? How can they employ new techniques? This film uses a different kind of visual storytelling technique. We're going to get to that in just a second. And let me go ahead and introduce my guests. On the line with us, a couple of SOTUS natives. Devin Lawrence is the director and writer of Sympathy Said the Shark. And Devin, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, Matthew Morgittis is also on the line with us, a producer of Sympathy Said the Shark. And Matthew, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Scott Pukas is here, and Scott is the public relations coordinator for the Little Theater, which will welcome Sympathy Said the Shark. When, Scott?
It's going to be playing Wednesday, January 13th, a week from today at 7 p.m. You can buy tickets at thelittle.org.
And they, the filmmakers have a little talk back as well, Scott?
Yeah, so at least we'll be there. I think Devin will be there, if that's correct. So.
We've got some local roots before we even get into all of that. So Devin and Matthew, Devin, where are you right now? Where are we talking to you from?
I'm in Los Angeles under the pouring rain right now.
Very good. And and Matthew, you?
I'm in Los Angeles too, right, underneath the rain.
Very good. You guys grew up where? Tell us about that.
I'll take it. We both were born like in SOTUS. And, you know, I'm a few years older than Matt, and I was more friends with his brothers growing up, but we literally lived directly across the street from each other in the beginning of it, like right across Route 88. And both of my parents were teachers in SOTUS. My father was the guidance counselor, vice principal of the middle school. My mom was a kindergarten teacher, and my mother actually taught Matt kindergarten.
Wow.
And it's funny, a couple of years ago this photo surfaced that my mom has that shows me, and I think I'm in like fifth or sixth grade, and I'm actually reading to her class, and Matt is like Matt's like 5 years old, just standing there right next to me staring at the book.
Well, now that
this is a really good story.
Now that you guys are moving forward with this film and you've already had some success with it, you travel. I've seen a couple of interviews, and you do say Rochester is home. You know, so no offense
so
to SOTUS.
I moved to Pittsburgh in fifth grade. My parents opened up Olives, which is on the canal.
Yep.
There. And so I moved to Pittsburgh, and then I grew up there, and then I moved when I was 19.
And how did you both end up in film, and how did you end up working together?
Well, for me, I kind of started making movies when I was about 12 with my brother and my friends, and you know, we were just messing around, and then eventually my brother, he graduated, and it was like, well, somebody's got to hold the camera. And because my parents own the camera, somehow that was defaulted to me. And so I was then behind the camera. And then through high school, my friends and I, we would, you know, at any excuse, we would shoot a video for school. Like if there was any kind of book report or anything, we would find a way to instead shoot, instead of writing a paper, we would make a movie about it. And so we ended up, you know, doing that and making videos. And I mean, it's, you know, honestly, at least back then, it was the easiest way to guarantee yourself an A. If the teachers rolled out the VCR and the TV into the room, it was on.
You know,
you're golden.
I think that's right. I mean, we made some terrible little videos back when I was growing up as well here, and it did work pretty well. That was a very effective technique. But you know, one of the things I want to talk to you guys about is what you've chosen to do with your filmmaking, and some of the techniques you've used in creating this film. We'll get to that in a second, but let's just talk a little bit about what the film is. So, Sympathy Said the Shark. It's a very interesting title and a very interesting reason for the title. So, Devin, I'll start with you. As the director and writer of the film, why don't you let the audience, let them in on a short synopsis of the film, which I've had a chance to watch over today. But why don't you go ahead and let people know kind of where it opens and what the premise is?
Yeah, so, you know, as you stated, it is a psychological thriller. And, you know, the film is about, you know, a couple ordinary night that gets disrupted by, you know, this estranged friend just, you know, pounding on their door. They let him in. He runs in. He's, you know, bloody, wet, and he's claiming that somebody's out there trying to kill him. And this kind of triggers this relentless, nonstop night of all these darker secrets from all of the characters kind of pouring out onto the table. And the characters are, you know, forced to confront, you know, their own secrets as well as everyone else's. And basically, you know, it's up to them to kind of make amends before this much larger, darker force comes down upon the house. And I like to say that, you know, they have to, you know, it's up to them. They must forgive each other to save themselves. Is kind of the thing.
And so the name of the film comes from that. Explain a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I never thought the title would make it this far. I was pretty certain that someone was going to force me, you know, a producer, executive producer, distributor, that somebody was going to be like, what is this? This will not fly. But the title was there from the very, very beginning. And, you know, Sympathy Said the Shark, and in regards, there is no shark in the movie. That's a spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Just put that out.
No
there.
Sharks.
But sharks, you know, I was always thinking, you know, sharks being natural predators, right? Sharks are natural predators. They're born to kill. They're born to eat, to survive. And knowing that that's the shark mentality, what do you do when the shark itself asks for sympathy, for mercy? When you know that if the tables were turned, the shark would probably devour you. And so under that, you know, thinking about that, you know, all of the characters in our story have all consciously wronged each other, but they also still love each other. And so it's about, you know, them coming to terms with that and trying to find a way to forgive and survive.
Talking to Devin Lawrence, along with Matthew Morgenis, who are the director and writer and the producer of Sympathy Said the Shark, the new film that will be at the Little Theater next week. And also here with me on Connections is Scott Pukas, who is the public relations coordinator for the Little Theater. And Scott, for me, the first real part of the film that makes me say this is something different is what you see pretty early on, which is the POV, the point of view filmmaking. And I'm trying to recall in my own mind, you see more movies than I do, Scott. I don't recall much that's been done this way. Do you?
I was trying to think I'm like other movies that are like this. And the only thing that I can think of that's even similar is some video games. It's like a first person video game where it's that type of thing. And we were talking about psychological thrillers earlier, and I said it kind of reminded me of Christopher Nolan, his second film, actually, his first big one, Memento, where it was all told backward, where it's just a storyteller or a technique of doing something different and innovative. And that's kind of what it reminded me of here.
Yeah, this isn't exactly like Memento, which worked backwards, but this lets you work through their backstories, sort of unraveling layer by layer as you start to realize these three people, who they are and how they've hurt each other. And how they have to work through that. So, but the POV, the point of view filmmaking, I guess I'll do my best to describe it, and then I'll let Devin and Matthew kind of explain. You chose to tell the story in a way that we, at various points, we see the action directly from the point of view of one of the three characters. And we see maybe a minute to two at a time in that way, and then it will cut to somebody else's point of view, and you kind of work back maybe 30 seconds and you see what they were seeing, but it starts to fill in gaps because one person might leave the house or leave a room and you don't exactly know what they're doing or what's happening. And then when you switch point of view, you start to fill in some of the missing pieces. And a very interesting approach, again, I haven't seen. So Devin, Matthew, whose idea was this?
Well, it was all Devin's idea, and the main thing is we only had a certain amount of money to make this movie, and we wanted to make this movie and make it interesting and and have a way that's never been done before. And Devin came up with a POV idea, and he pitched it to us, and we were like, yeah, it's amazing. And then it just went from there.
So so before we talk a little bit more about how it works into the story, just the mechanism of doing it, I saw a picture of somebody. I couldn't actually tell who was underneath it. The contraption, the POV contraption, it looked it's very interesting. Can you guys tweet a picture of that so our audience can see it? Because you had to kind of, you shoot a scene from one perspective, then you've got to shoot it from a different character's POV. Was that one of you guys who was actually wearing the POV, switching off? Who was doing that?
In the photo that I think you're talking about, that is our director of photography, Mark LaFleur, who, really great friend of mine. We actually went to college. We went to film school together. So we've been, you know, collaborators for a long, long time. And that was something, you know, when, you know, the shooting it POV style, you know, came to me, and it was really, you know, one of those things. I'm all, you know, I really strive. I want to tell compelling stories in interesting ways, you know, doing something unique, you know, always, you know, I think we're always trying to, you know, every story's been told and to do it a different way. That is, you know, the objective. And so, you know, and like I was saying with the secrets and the lies, and that was really the motivation to do the POV. And it came out of that, you know, I really didn't want to use it as a visual gimmick. You know, it needed to be something that was inherent to telling this particular story. And so in doing that and thinking about the way that, you know, we are so kind of reactionary to things that we see and the immediacy of it, you know, as we see something and being judgmental. And like, if just knowing a little bit more, a little of the backstory, a little about what happened before or what we missed, and how that can change your entire perspective of a situation and a person, that was what really kind of brought the POV device into itself and came to a way to tell this story. And so it's always, the movie is about 80% shot from these explicit POVs of the three main characters. And so whenever there's another character enters the realm, the movie goes back to traditional photography.
Now,
when the three are, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to jump in and ask you, you know, you say, you know, you kind of settled on this technique and you immediately saw the potential for it, not just because it's unique, but because it can be very effective. But as filmmakers, mm-hmm. you also said you felt like you didn't want it to become a gimmick. How do you make sure you're not overusing a new technique like that?
I think it really is all about, you have to make sure that it's necessary for telling the story. You know, versus there have been films that have used, you know, the POV shot, you know, and especially splicing it into action movies, or there's been other great uses of it, like in the movie Enter the Void, and where they do the, gives you a certain aesthetic, visual aesthetic and everything. But, you know, how we did it, I had to justify that, you know, as you stated earlier, like every time the POV switches, there's a slight overlap of time, and like within that overlap, you needed to, you know, process new information and receive new information that changed things. And so that was a big part to keep, it always had to be motivated that there was a reason why we were switching point of views and why we were overlapping. In another part of this, and I guess this does go to the overall POV aesthetic, but, you know, and it also lends itself to, you know, us being on the shoestring, you know, micro budget, is that, you know, the POV really does get you as close to that character as possible. You know, it makes it as visceral, you know, as we found in any other technique, so that, like, when you're really feeling at one with these characters, it's the slightest thing is magnified because it feels so close to you, like a punch or a reveal or a wound or something, like, is magnified that much bigger versus going to a blockbuster and seeing, like, explosions every second.
I actually thought that would make it, you know, when I was watching the film, I thought that had to make it more challenging for the actors, because sometimes they had to do scenes, I'm sure, a couple of times from different perspectives. And sometimes when you had these physical confrontations, when you were seeing it up close, I'm thinking of your artistic director who's wearing this contraption and one of the actors maybe getting ready to throw a punch or that kind of thing. How do you You know, how do you make sure that when you're that up close that it's being delivered authentically? And it's sort of a strange question, but it is really intimate the way you shot it.
Well, like, it's really hard, actually. We had a person I was pulling the focus in a garage while either our DP or the actor would wear the helmet. And the whole set, it wasn't like a normal movie set where there would be a bunch of lights everywhere. It had to be like almost like a theater where it was just completely open. And it was really hard to do.
Yeah, I mean, almost every, like Matt was saying, and really there are so many aspects of this that are outside the realm of traditional filmmaking, the way that we had to approach it, you know, based on that. And yeah, for about the majority of it, our DP, the director of photography, he's wearing the helmet, the rig himself. And in a lot of times he's actually dressed, he's in the full costume and makeup of the male characters. And so we can see his hands and his, and he looks down and you can see his body and he's in the full costume and makeup. And directly behind him is the actor that he's playing. And so what would happen is we would rehearse a scene with the three actors, and Mark, the cinematographer, he would kind of shadow and watch what they were doing. We would block it all out organically and change things. And then at some point he would swap in and he would mimic the movements that the actor naturally came to during our traditional blocking. And so he would know exactly how the character would be moving in that scene, and the actor would still be directly behind him, kind of steering him, and the actor would be delivering an authentic performance directly behind the cinematographer he's filming.
That's a lot of work, man.
Yeah. And I mean, I could go on forever about the process of that. And like you were saying, I mean, it's very different for even the actors themselves, because I love when they've stated this, that it tells them to break rule one of acting for film, which is to not look into the camera. So that was the hardest thing for the actors to do, was to go against their, what's been grained into them over their, you know, over their lives, is to, they had to act directly into the camera and look directly into the lens. And that was something very, very different from them. And, you know, hard thing to get over.
Yeah, I think at first for me, it was jarring because you're just not used to it as a viewer. But, you know, you sort of get used to it. And, you know, just as an example of how that technique was used, there's a scene early on where the couple is inside the house with this guy who had bolted in bleeding and claiming that someone was after him. They had their own discussions and things got a little nasty. He runs and leaves the house. And then you see some dialogue between the couple for a couple of minutes. And then all of a sudden the guy runs back into the house, basically saying, you know, they're here, get down. And you don't know what he saw outside until you see it from his perspective, which is that at, by that point, I could see the value in that technique, because then as a viewer, you start to know, oh, I don't know yet what this person just experienced, but I will in a moment. And you had me anticipating that. So again, I suspect that that's what you're going for. But that was just one example of how that technique became, you know, sort of very effective and very interesting early on.
Great. Yeah, that's definitely what we were going for. And we've been, it was an experiment for us, for men. We had never done anything like that. You know, our cinematographer had never done anything like that. And I mean, even from when we were filming and there was like whispers going on set and people were like, I don't know what this is going to look like. I don't know what's going to go on. And so we were always, you know, rolling the dice and trying to keep the faith that it would all, you know, in theory it worked and that it would all come together like it did. And, you know, some of the greatest, you know, compliments that we've received after people watching the movie is that how, like you said, how intimate it does feel, like you with the characters, and how non-disruptive, like how used to, like a lot of people say that, you know, after the first 10 minutes, you completely forget that you're watching a POV movie and that you are just in the film and that it isn't like jarring and disruptive. It really just creates this kind of bond between you and the characters.
We're talking to Devin Lawrence and Matthew Morgiddis, who are the filmmakers, the people behind the new film, Sympathy Said the Shark. They are SOTUS natives, so they're out in L.A., but really repping Rochester for us here. And they'll be back in Rochester next week as Sympathy Said the Shark, their new film, debuts at the Little Theater. Scott Pukas from the Little Theater is here as well. So remind the audience, the film is coming when, Scott?
It's a week from today, Wednesday, January 13th at 7 o'clock.
And you guys are also kind of, it looks like a little bit of a tour here. So I want you to explain to the audience as best you can, Devin and Matt, the process of not just coming back to Rochester to the Little Theater, but you're in different cities now. The film is starting to move. And, you know, anybody who makes a film has no idea early on, unless you're in a big, big studio, right, where it's going, who's picking it up, and you know, how many people are going to have a chance to put their eyeballs on it. And can you kind of work us through, as filmmakers, that process, what it has been like for you, and when the kind of drip, drip, drip of success started to really maybe become more of a flow for you?
Well, I know the first thing I wanted to do is to premiere the film in Rochester. Like before the film was even made, I told Devin, I was like, we have to premiere this in Rochester, because it's just a great story that we have. His mom was my kindergarten teacher. We grew up across the street from each other. And that was my whole idea the whole time. Whether it gets a whole run at the Little or just a day at the Little, I wanted to do that. And I'll let Devin explain the whole process of us actually selling the film.
Yeah, and Matt's completely correct about that. And I mean, I remember I used to go and drag my friends, bring my friends, drive them out from SOTUS to go see independent films at the Little. I mean, back when I was 16, you know, so it's always been, that's, you know, the full circle. I think, you know, everybody's always trying to get back home. And so, like Matt said, I mean, it means a lot for us to be able to come back and bring the film home and, you know, show it, share it with our, you know, with our city and the people that we grew up with and grew up with making movies and having these dreams together. And so that's always been kind of a light at the end of the tunnel. And as far as the tunnel, I mean, it is, like you said, outside of this, if you're making a film outside of the studio system, it is a long, treacherous path. And I mean, all along the way, it's kind of the thing as an independent filmmaker, you know, the hardest thing is obviously securing the financing. And so when that happens, you think, okay, we did it. Our goal, our dreams are set, we're going to do it. And then you go into production, you finish the movie, and you're like, okay, we did it, we finally accomplished it, all right, let's go. And there's still another, the next road. And then you're out there, you're submitting to film festivals, and you're like, okay, now we just got to get into a film festival, then we're all set. And then you finally do that, and then you still have to get a distributor. And then you work, you know, work as hard as you can, and then you finally get a distributor, and then you still got to get it on the market. And every along the way, every kind of achievement leads to a new obstacle that you have to climb, and you're always, you know, it's on you, you know, it's on you and your team. And that's why it's, you know, so important to work when you're making a film. It's so important to work with people that you know and you trust and that you have these long relationships. You know, Matt and I, you know, we've also, you know, we've been making films and doing things together for, you know, like 7 years now, like nonstop. And, you know, you create those bonds that are going to last and get you through the trying times of.
And then you find your crew members that way.
Yeah. And sitting at home and waiting to hear if you got accepted to a film festival or if somebody's going to pick you up. And so, and then, you know, that leads to, kind of what we're doing right now with the film and taking it, you know, kind of across country, kind of like a old school road show.
Yeah, where are you going, Devin?
So we are starting in Phoenix, and we wanted to do this to kind of obviously share the movie. We're doing Q&As, talkbacks after every screening, and, you know, we wanted to get to certain cities where, you know, we either had a presence or you know, knew we could create a draw. And so it was very, you know, strategic to which cities we're going to. And so we're starting in Phoenix on the 9th, and that screening's already sold out. That's sold out in like 2 days. And it that one, then we're going, we're jumping up to Chicago, where our other producer, Casey Morris, she's from Chicago, and so we're going to kind of her hometown to do the thing, and she really wanted to bring the film back there, and we have a really good support. And then we will be obviously in Rochester on the 13th, and then we will wind up back in LA on the 15th for the LA premiere, and that will coincide with our digital release date. And so on the 15th, the film will be available, I think, you know, nationwide on all major VOD platforms.
And you won the audience award in Phoenix, in Portland. And I'm curious to know what does that mean to you as filmmakers when you go through this kind of a process? And like you said, you don't know where it ends up. And then you start to get, more interest around the country. You pick up an award like that. What is that like?
Well, the audience award is the best award to win at any film festival because it's what the audience liked the most. And I can speak for Devin, we were all surprised, and it was a huge night for us that night that we won that award. And I know it helped, like, as far as film buff goes, right, Devin?
I was going to say, no one was more surprised than we were when we won. And like Matt said, I think, someone actually told us there, regarding the audience award, because there's the jury awards and then there's the audience awards. And, somebody there told us, they're like, well, anybody can sleep with the jury, but nobody can sleep with the entire audience.
That's not a line that you ever expect to hear on Connections.
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say here, I am late for a break. Let's do this. Devin and Matt are on the line with us. Devin's the director and writer of Sympathy Said the Shark, the new film. Matthew Morgittis, the producer of Sympathy Said the Shark. So Does Natives, coming back to Rochester next week to the Little Theater. And Scott Pukas from the Little Theater is in studio with me. When we come back, we're going to have a kind of a discussion with these filmmakers, not only about their film, but about what they think works in psychological thrillers, and we'll talk about some of their favorites. I have one of mine. Scott's chosen one of his. We've got some film clips as well, and some of our listeners have been weighing in on Twitter on some of their favorite psychological thrillers. Maybe Sympathy Said the Shark ends up in this canon for some of our listeners as well here. So short break, and we'll come right back with the filmmakers next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connection, you might have seen a video about open-air drug markets in Rochester that's been making the rounds. The people who made the video want to clarify. What are the open-air drug markets and what aren't they? Where are they and how does it impact people who live in those city neighborhoods? Then second hour, comedian Judy Gold, she's coming to Rochester talking primarily about gay couples and parenting. That's Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Devin, Matt, Scott, I get to go first since I'm the host of the program in sharing my favorite psychological thriller, and I'm really going to expose myself to some ridicule, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'll date myself, and I will start with this. It was 17 years ago this film came out, and I was a college student, and this was at the time, 1999, the internet was still new. We were still using dial-up connections, back in those days. So nobody had the internet on their phones. Nobody could debunk a rumor in 5 seconds. I'm not even sure Snopes.com existed yet. And the rumor was that this film called The Blair Witch Project was a real thing, that this was an actual piece of footage found. And, I was a not very bright college student who thought maybe. I don't think I actually, by the time I got to the theater, I think I realized probably not. But it was interesting for a while because this movie was coming out, and for a while there was this rumor campaign. I'm not crazy. Do you have any recollection of this, Scott Pukas?
I remember I was a little younger, and I remember, I'm like, is this real? And it kind of freaked me out. And I actually didn't end up seeing it in theaters. I think I saw The Matrix a bunch of times instead. But
well, so I saw it, and for me, a great horror or psychological film is not relying on excess of gore, excess of over-the-top physical imagery. It relies on sort of a buildup of what you know and what you don't know, and trying to figure things out and using that sort of psychological issue. So for our listeners who are laughing at me saying, really, the Blair Witch worked on you? It did. And Val, are you shaking your head back there? Come on, it's classic now. Val, our engineer is laughing at me. But the film is about three people who set out to make a documentary film about whether this witch that haunted the woods in Maryland was real. And supposedly what you find is what was left of their films after they were, I don't know, eaten by the witch or whatever happened. And they lose the map. They start to be sort of haunted in the woods overnight by these things. And then one of their filmmakers disappears. And the scene you're going to hear is the classic crying scene. This is the female of the group talking to her camera late at night when she realizes that they're probably never making it out of the woods alive.
Everything had to be my way. And this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted. I love you, Mom. And Dad. I'm so sorry.
All right, so for me, that worked. Devin and Matt, did that work for you?
Well, look, it was the first found footage film, wasn't it?
It was the first what?
I think it was.
Found footage. Scott, a quick definition. Found footage, I guess, is...
That's why people thought it was real. They're like, we just found this footage out there. This is what happened. Fargo did something similar, actually, in the earlier 90s. Where, like, this is based on a true story. It wasn't found footage, but it was kind of a similar thing where it kind of gave you the fake out, thinking it's true.
All right, Val weighs in and says, awful, yes, but seminal for the found footage genre. Come on, Val. I can't go back to... or maybe that's what Megan is saying, our producer. But I can't go back to my college days and relive it perfectly. All I can tell you is that at the time, as a college student, it worked on me. Devin and Matt, what were your thoughts?
Well, I was in college as well. And I actually thought, I went to see it in the theater. And this was I was actually in Vegas, like, visiting my brother. And I was in the theater, saw about two-thirds of the movie, and then the film burned up in the projector. And for a second, I thought that was part of the movie, and that this was part of the gimmick. And no, the film burned up, and that was it. And I never saw the rest of it. But, you know, going with what you said, like, even when you went into the movie, and there were all the rumors, and you were skeptical, and you were pretty sure that it, you know, was fabricated and everything. But in what the movie did really well was it broke down those guards, you know, over the slow burn of the movie itself. It you know, slowly wore down, you know, all the preconceived notions that you had, and it just got you, and it dragged you into its world. And I think that's why, you know, the Blair Witch worked on many levels and still worked even when you went in there thinking it was false, was this ability to kind of wear you down over the course of the movie and then really grab you at the end.
Yeah, see, so I'm opening myself up there for a little bit of ridicule, but for me, that was one of the first that came to mind. Scott Pukos, for you, psychological thriller, your favorite.
Yeah, first of all, I would defend you on Blair Witch Project. I mean, I think that scene that we showed the clip of or heard the clip, it's kind of iconic. For me, the first movie I thought of was Memento, which I mentioned earlier. So it's a 2000 film from Christopher Nolan, his second film after Following. Guy Pearce plays a man named Leonard. He has short-term memory loss. He can't make new memories, and he's looking for his wife's killer. So it's a mystery one, but it has that twist where, you know, he can't remember anything. He has tattoos throughout his body. He leaves notes. And kind of the innovative part of that is the film is told backwards. So it's different filmmaking. Like the beginning of the movie is actually the end, and it's told backwards. And I think there's some versions where you can watch it for the correct way.
People have actually moved it around. How interesting. The film is Memento. We've got a clip here. And Scott, can you set up what we're about to hear from Memento?
This is with Carrie Ann Moss's character, Natalie. She's in a diner with Leonard, which is, again, Kai Pierce's character. And they're just discussing his condition and how he combats with this memory loss.
Natalie.
You don't remember me.
I'm sorry. I should have explained. I have this...
You did explain, Lenny.
Please call me Leonard. My wife called me Lenny.
Yeah, I know. You told me.
Well, then I probably told you how much I hated it.
Yeah.
Do you mind taking your glasses off? It's hard for me to... Thanks. So you have information for me.
Is that what your little note says?
Yeah.
Must be tough living your life according to a couple of scraps of paper. You mix your laundry list with your grocery list and you'll end up eating your underwear for breakfast. I guess that's why you have those freaky tattoos.
Yeah, it's tough. It's almost impossible. Look, I'm sorry I don't remember you. It's nothing personal.
I do have information for you. You gave me a license plate number. Had my friend at DMV trace it. Guess what name came up? John Edward Gammel, John G.
Do you know him?
No. But his face on his driver's license looked really familiar. I think he's been in the bar, maybe. Here's a copy of his license, his registration, photo and all. Are you sure you want this?
Have I told you what this man did?
Yeah.
Well, then you shouldn't have to ask.
But even if you get revenge, you're not gonna remember it. You're not even gonna know that it happened.
My wife deserves vengeance. Doesn't make any difference whether I know about it. Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless. The world doesn't just disappear when you close your eyes, does it?
That's from Memento. So, Scott, what did you love most about it?
Like I said, just the, you know, I'm a big fan of storytelling, and just the way that Christopher Nolan told that story was just something I'd never seen before, and I was completely captivated. Another thing that I really like in any movie, psychological thriller or otherwise, is a good twist ending, which that one has. There's a lot of plot twists. I won't give that away, obviously.
It has a twist ending, but you get the ending first, so it has a twist beginning.
Yes, in right? a way, in a sense, yes.
You know, so, all right, so Devin and Matt, I'm starting to see a similar thread here. Your film, Sympathy Said the Shark, has this POV, you know, style storytelling that, if not the first time ever used, it's certainly rather unusual for the genre. Blair Witch had this found footage. Memento had this backward storytelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not saying that to make a great psychological thriller you need sort of a twist style, but I'm saying that, you know, it can help, you know, spur a point of interest as long as the storytelling is still great. And I'm assuming you guys would agree, you still have to have great storytelling no matter what style of film, you know, technique you have.
Right. I think, yeah, it still boils down to, you know, telling these compelling stories in interesting ways and doing it differently. And, yeah, I mean, if I had my pick, I probably would have picked Memento as well.
It's, you know, such a popular
pick. Yes, of all time.
Did you say as well, Matthew? Yes, Memento?
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I'm going over...
compared to Memento, actually. I think it was at Portland. We were compared to Memento just as far as the storytelling.
And that's our distributor when, you know, they were kind of wooing us, and they compared our film to Memento and Rashomon, and that was like, all right, deal, let's go. You guys get it.
Well, I'm looking over our Twitter feed here. Listeners mentioning their favorite. A lot of people saying Memento. Seth says we need to talk about Kevin. Daniel says Mulholland Drive, one of my favorite films ever. George says Goodnight, Mommy. I don't know that.
That played at the Little as well.
Okay. let's see here. Arch says House of Games, Mulholland Drive, Chinatown, Vertigo, Shadow of a Doubt, all candidates. And
Shining.
Did you say The Shining?
Yeah, The Shining is great. Psychological film.
I just rewatched this 2 weeks ago with Jacob's Ladder, which is brilliant, with Tim Robbins. Anybody remember?
Another one with a good twist ending too. That one.
Yeah, a great twist ending, and I think, you know, a lot of consistencies with like Memento, Jacob's Ladder, in other films, Mulholland Drive. I think what the successful psychological thriller is the use of the unreliable narrator in literary terms, you know, is that or unreliable protagonist, that main character who you are with from the beginning and you're in their, you know, you're watching the story from their point of view and from their side, and slowly you see them, you see their flaws and you see them unravel until you realize they're not at all who you first thought they were.
Yeah, I think that's well said. In fact, in just a second, I'm going to start asking you on that very theme about the characters in Sympathy Said the Shark. Just to squeeze in a few more from our listeners, Jasko said his favorite thriller, psychological thriller, was Buffalo Bills 30 for 30. ESPN. That's a sad state of affairs. Yeah, too soon for Western New Yorkers. And Adam says Black Swan, which I did not see. But let's listen to a clip from Sympathy Said the Shark. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Devin Lawrence, the director and writer of the new film, and Matthew Morgiddis, the producer. They are SOTUS natives coming back to Rochester next Wednesday night. What time, Scott, at the Little Theater?
7 o'clock, January 13th. You can get tickets at thelittle.org.
And that's at the Little next Wednesday. And so this is a clip. And I have got to say, Megan Mack, the producer of this program, had to work hard to find a clip that didn't have language that would be objectionable for the audience. So Megan found the only 54 seconds in the film that fits this. I'm mostly kidding, but I'm pretty sure we're going to get a clean clip here. And this is a scene in which Slate, played by Richard Gunn, is threatening Justin, Laura, and Church, the main three that we've been talking about. So he comes in later, and he's I don't want to give too much away, but he's threatening them with a knife as he tries to find the location of the envelope that has become so controversial. Let's listen to this scene.
Well, I've dug the dirtiest secrets out of the dirtiest men. Junkies so high on meth that most of their nerve endings, you know, the pain sensors, they're already shorted out. I dig around until locating that single nerve that was still firing. Mm-hmm. And then twisted back and forth until that man was squealing like a baby in a brush fire.
Torture me all you want. I'm not saying another word.
I'm not gonna torture you. I was just reminding you what pain feels like so you'll fully comprehend what you're putting this beautiful woman through.
Justin. All right, so in that scene there, well, you know, again, you don't want to give too much away, but there are questions not only about the envelope, but what's in it and who it implicates, who's involved. So, Devin, I'll start with you. You want to tell us a little bit more about what we just heard?
Yeah, I'm impressed that that Megan did find a clean,
I know,
clean clip. And I was obviously, before you played it, I was racking my brain. I was like, where could that be?
You know, it's a fair question, because Megan even said to me as the clip was playing, you know, they're ready with the dump button in case you got one wrong. But she didn't.
Yeah. But, yeah, that happened. I mean, it was for one of the characters. I mean, it's very much a part of his persona in the way he kind of drops F-bombs, I guess, around the room. I guess, yeah, it's hard to explain. I'm glad that was a better clip than I would have picked out. That was one of my favorite scenes. I think it's one of everybody's favorite scenes in the film. And it's hard to go into too much detail without stealing, you know, or betraying some of the twists and the reveals within that. But like you said, that is exactly, it's when later in the film when Slate comes in and confronts them. And, you know, a little interesting anecdote, I guess, before that is that Richard Gunn, who plays Slate, and it was amazing when we were casting that role and we were holding auditions, and we had an actor come in before Richard. And he came in and he was very threatening. You know, I think he was, you know, Romanian or had this Eastern European accent. And his name was something vampiric as well. And he came in and he like laid it down and he was really aggressive and, you know, threatening with reading that same scene. And we were like, whoa, that is pretty scary. And then he left, and then Richard came in and delivered it just almost, you know, 99%, which you just heard in the movie. And he came at it, and it just goes to show you, like, the different, like, actors, different approaches. And he came at it with this drawl, this laid back, and just the way he delivered, you know, way he approached it was just so much more menacing. you know, like the way he kind of delivers those lines. And we were just floored, and he instantly had the part.
Sure, and that's probably the moment where you don't need over the top. You know, you already have Church, who's over the top. You don't need in that moment someone who is ratcheting it up, because I thought just that, as you said, that menacing sort of slow, deliberate, that kind of delivery was much more effective, I would think, than something that's over the top.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Like, and we were surprised, and I mean, that's the kind of scene it was. And kind of going back to what you were saying with psychological thrillers, and it's not about the gore. You know, it's not about the extreme violence and the gore that you're doing. You know, it is that slow burn. It's that getting under your skin. You know, that really does it. And it's allowing, you know, when it's a psychological thriller, it's not even as much as, you know, the characters, you know, in regards to psychological. It's a lot about the viewer. It's a lot about the audience and what they're going through psychologically, and what you're thinking, what's going, the gears that are turning in your mind as you're watching it, and how you're, you know, you're guessing what this really means or what he's done in the past versus what you're just seeing on screen and being kind of hit with violence-wise.
Kelly on Twitter says, unreliable narrator in Fight Club. Just another example as we talk about different techniques. Mm-hmm. As some of the feedback rolls in, we've been talking about psychological thrillers. And I want to close the hour just by talking a little bit about how Devin and Matt view character development. And Scott Pukas, I want to ask you, when you watch this film, early on, you meet the main couple, and then you meet the third of the three main characters who you see for a while in the film, and you start to learn about what they have done in their past, mm-hmm. and the ways that they have kind of wronged each other, and you know, so I want to know if you found them. Did you find yourself saying, "Boy, you know, they've really done some terrible things to each other. It's hard to root for them," or did you think this makes them real people? You know, this people have flaws, people have secrets. Mm.
Yeah, I thought it added a complexity. It reminded me, I had a creative writing class in college, and we had to write a story where you were doing it from the point of view of one character, and then they were telling another character, they were conversing with them, but they had to have a secret that the other person didn't know. So it reminded me of that. Like, each scene, there's something, they each have a secret, and it slowly gets unraveled. And that's where the point of view perspective really comes in handy, is you'll see one scene, and then you'll see it again, you'll be like, oh, with this added element. So yeah, I thought that just added, it made them more realistic. I mean, it did make them a little less, it wasn't as easy to root for them, because you're like, okay, they've done some horrible things, but it wasn't, it was more realistic in the horribleness. So I think, which we all to some degree could relate to.
Sure. And so Devin, as the writer of Sympathy Said the Shark, how do you balance that? Making sure you don't lose the audience's rooting for characters while giving them real edge, you know, secrets, flaws that are you know, believable.
I do think it's all about the motivation in letting, you know, making sure the audience is aware of that, you know, that, you know, why people have done what they've done, you know, and as long as those reasons are justifiable and relatable, then you will still, you know, root for the character and believe in the character. And for me, when I was writing this and kind of developing, you know, the story, and had these kind of three characters in a house and running around and unraveling. And, you know, I was thinking a lot about, you know, relationships, my past relationships and things, and, you know, wondering about, you know, what I've, you know, been through and gone through. You know, you tend to do that a lot as all of your friends around you are getting married and starting families, and you kind of get a little, you know, the introspective on things, and you're, you know, going through telling, you know, your past. And in a lot of the other characters, in, you know, two of the main characters are a composite of my relationship with my brother is a lot in there, and then also, you know, another person from back home who I had kind of grown up with. And like, when I was going back and doing a lot of, you know, visiting back home and my parents, and I was going back in between hiatuses on the show that I edit for, Ghost Adventures, I was going home and hanging out with and, you know, old friends. And a lot of it was infusing into these characters along with, like I said, my relationship with my brother. And there was a lot of that in exploring it. And I think that's one of the great things about, you know, storytelling and filmmaking is it's a very almost therapeutic to yourself because it gives you a chance if you set up these characters and you infuse part of yourself within them, it gives you an excuse to kind of work through your own situation and your own issues. And like you said, if you can find a way of how those were motivated and everything, you can kind of find a way to deal with yourself.
Well, I'm down about our last minute here. Are you guys going to come back to Rochester and make any films around here?
Yes, Matt was actually just location scouting, right? Do you tell me about that?
In Rolling Hills, so outside of Rochester, I think it's near Batavia. We're thinking about doing this movie on a Devon Road called Winter Wonderland. And it's between that and another movie right now. But if we do the Winter Wonderland, it'll be shot in Rochester.
Winter Wonderland sounds like a nice, happy, relaxed, yeah?
It is another psychological thriller with very flawed and tormented characters who are, you know, forced into each other. And we had location scouted in Rochester a few years back. And actually that movie, because it does take place in the dead of winter, in a blizzard, and that was a go movie, and then we missed the winter, and that's actually, then we went back and we focused on Sympathy Said the Shark with the hopes of coming back to Rochester and making Winter Wonderland. So, you know, hopefully that can come together.
The film is Sympathy Said the Shark. It's coming to Rochester one more time. Scott Pukos, The Little Theater.
Wednesday, January 13th at 7 o'clock. Tickets at thelittle.org.
Thank you, Scott Pukos from The Little Theater, for being here, sharing this film with us. Devin and Matthew, thank you very much for your time this hour. Good luck to you in your filmmaking careers. And thanks for checking back in with your hometown.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. See you soon. Thanks for listening today. And Valerie LaBanca, thanks for tolerating the host's terrible tastes in movies. Valerie's the engineer with much better taste in films, as does Megan Mack, the producer of Connections. I am Evan Dawson, bad taste in all, your host. We'll talk to you on a Thursday.